You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. It is Friday. So, of course, it is time for Brunch with Bernie. Senator Bernie, the guy I think of as America's senator, although Vermonters know he's their senator, and boy, are they pleased about it. Just reelected him. Senator Sanders, welcome back to the program.
Great to be with you, Tom.
I understand that the Business Roundtable, this shadowy group of the 100 CEOs, the largest companies in the world or in America, has some thoughts on Social Security. And I'm curious your thoughts on what happened with the filibuster.
Well, those are two really big issues. I think what interests me is that you have the Business Roundtable, which is essentially the organization representing the major corporations of America. Some of the corporations represented are Boeing, Honeywell, Dow, Procter & Gamble, MasterCard, Xerox, American Express, Eaton, J.P. Morgan Chase. This is it. And these are the guys who, by and large, in the last number of years, have been doing extremely well. Profits are high. Many of the CEOs are worth tens of millions of dollars, if not more. Virtually all of them have very, very strong retirement programs for themselves. And they came up with a proposal reported in the Washington Post on January 18th, which calls for raising the eligibility age for both Social Security and Medicare to 70 years of age. So you have people, CEOs of large corporations who are phenomenally wealthy, running companies that in many ways are making record-breaking profits, folks who themselves have retirement packages that most people couldn't begin to dream about. And they are saying that what we have got to do is make it harder for working families, for the middle class, to have any kind of decent or secure retirement. Raising the eligibility age for Medicare to 70 from 65 would be an unparalleled disaster. Imagine how many people would find it impossible to find affordable health insurance. How many people would unnecessarily die or suffer? Imagine raising the retirement age for Social Security when you get benefits to the age of 70 and the amount of suffering that that would entail. So at a time when the wealthiest people in this country are doing phenomenally well, while the middle class is shrinking, it is beyond arrogance for these Wall Street and CEO moguls to be telling American people that the deficit has got to be balanced on the backs of ordinary people. Meanwhile, all of these guys will do everything they can to prevent large corporations and the wealthiest people in this country from paying their fair share of taxes. But it gives you just an example, an idea of the arrogance that these folks have and the continued war that they are waging against working families and the middle class. Other issue I wanted to touch on briefly has to do with a vote that took place yesterday evening, and that was on the so-called filibuster reform, which turned out not really to be filibuster reform. Two issues that Congress, the Senate, was looking at is, number one, how do you make the Senate more efficient? How do you move things along at a fast clip in a body which is just waste an enormous amount of time because of a lot of arcane rules? The second and more important issue is how many votes does it require to pass a significant piece of legislation? I think the Senate made progress yesterday in making the body more efficient and moving things along in a faster clip. That's a step forward. But I voted against that legislation because I think at the end of the day, if we are going to address the major crises facing this country, and that is the decline of the middle class, massive unemployment, millions of people who continue not to have health insurance, young people graduating college deeply in debt, the major, major crisis of global warming, which if we do not address, is going to lead to devastating consequences, not only in our country, but throughout the world, et cetera, enormous problems out there. We are not going to be able to address those problems if we need 60 votes. We simply do not have the votes to overcome Republican filibuster. So my own view is the Senate is not the House. People who are in opposition should have as much time as they need to get down to the floor of the Senate, explain their point of view, and tell the American people why they are in opposition. That's called a talking filibuster. But I think it is wrong to continue a practice where a senator simply calls up the cloakroom and says, I'm going to put a hold on this legislation, and you're going to need 60 votes to overcome it. I think that that is wrong. It's undemocratic, and it's going to make it impossible for us to address the problems facing our country. So those are two of the issues, Tom, which seem to me to be standing out this week. I think the third point that I want to make is as of last night, I became chairman of the Senate Veterans Committee on Veterans Affairs. It is a committee that I'm going to put a lot of time and energy into. I'm honored to have accepted that responsibility. And I would love over the course of the shows that we do to hear from veterans, tell me what they like about the VA, and the VA has doing a lot of very good work, and to tell me about the problems that they see. I will tell you that I think it was about a year ago, we had a veteran call up the show who told us she was concerned that she walks into gift shops at the VA and found that many of the products being sold there were not manufactured in America. As a result of that phone call, we have set in progress a series of actions which will significantly and are already significantly increasing the percentage of products sold in those shops that are made in America. So love to hear from veterans on issues of concern to them.
That's great. And the phone number for any vet who wants to share thoughts with the new chairman of the Veterans Affairs Committee, Senator Bernie Sanders, is 866-987-THOM. Bernie, I'm curious, the Republicans have been in many cases kind of masters of theater when, you know, when they're obstructed or when there's a problem. You know, back, I remember, I think it was the Sam Alito nomination when the Democrats ran the Senate and they were, you know, huffing and puffing about the nuclear option and all this. Do you think that even though the rules haven't changed, is it possible that the Senate might get a little more theatrical in opposition to Republican filibusters, or is it still going to be kind of this quiet, nobody pays any attention to it?
Well, I think the good news is that senators like Jeff Merkley, Tom Udall, and others, and I've been working with them, have done a very good job in raising consciousness on the issue. So I hope that the Democrats will be more aggressive and demand as much debate as possible on given issues. What ends up happening, Tom, is because there are so many things that have to be dealt with, we let the Republicans get away with murder and simply withdraw a bill rather than forcing the kinds of discussion that the American people deserve.
Right. Okay. Thank you, Bernie. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us. He's taking your calls next here on Brunch with Bernie on the Tom Hartman Program. 15 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And, of course, you can sign up for Bernie's newsletter, the Bernie Buzz, over at sanders.senate.gov. It's also a great news site. Welcome back to the program where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no, not a chance. The Tom Hartman Program. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line taking your calls. And Cassie in Wilmington, Delaware, you're on the line with Senator Sanders.
Thanks for taking my call. I simply want to know, if Harry Reid had 47 senators with him, who are the 8 that he did not have with him? Because if they belong to any of us, we need to do something about them. Is there any way, since you're neither a Republican nor a Democrat, is there any way to find out who it is that threw us under the bus yesterday?
Well, I can tell you who was on the floor of the House, floor of the Senate, speaking about the issue. Carl Levin of Michigan is a very, very good senator, and he's doing a lot of good work in a lot of areas. On this issue, I think Carl had the feeling that moving toward a majority vote rather than the 60 votes is bad policy. That was Carl's view. He was on the floor of the Senate speaking to that point. So he is one who worked on that issue.
Whoops, here we go. Aaron, in Houston, Texas. Aaron, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Oh, hi, Senator. My question was about a living wage. What can we do, or I guess what can be done in the Senate, in order to pass legislation that at least raises minimum wage, if not establishes a firm living wage for people so that they, if they work a job, they're simply able to make a living for themselves. And from a conservative, reducing our spending perspective, allow people to not need government assistance because they're no longer part of the working poor.
Right. Well, Aaron, thanks for that question. You're absolutely right. Not only should we remember that today well over 14% of the American workforce is either unemployed or underemployed. That's a huge number. But as Aaron indicates, we have millions and millions of people who are working at low-wage jobs, and after working 40 hours a week, they are very lucky if they can pay off their housing and food bills and electricity and phone, etc. It has been quite a while since we have raised the minimum wage. There are states like the state of Vermont, my state, that has a significantly higher minimum wage than does the federal government. And I think it is time to be talking and moving forward. And I will be working with other senators on this to bring about significant increases in the minimum wage. This fight is not going to be an easy fight anymore than the fight to create the millions of jobs we need, rebuilding our infrastructure or transforming our energy system. I mentioned earlier in the show that groups like the Business Roundtable, representing the CEOs of major corporations, want to move in exactly the other direction. Instead of allowing us to improve life for working families, they want to do things like raise the retirement age for Medicare and Social Security, make life harder for ordinary people. So this is not going to be an easy fight, but I think Aaron is exactly right. We cannot continue to be on the defensive. We've got to be on the offensive, and the goal has got to be a massive investment in infrastructure, in energy, creating millions of jobs, raising the minimum wage, moving toward a livable wage so that anybody who works in this country will earn enough money to live with dignity, and that is certainly not the case right now.
John in Folsom, California, you're on the air with Senator Sanders. Thanks for listening to Sirius Satellite Radio.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Senator. I am one of those veterans. I'm a Vietnam veteran. I was 18 years old when I was a combat Marine, and I was exposed to Agent Orange. I had a heart attack 17 years ago, and the government ran from liability on Agent Orange for 35, 40 years, sir. And that's way too long for a veteran to have to wait.
Well, John, thank you very much for calling, and thank you for your service. And your point is exactly right. The sad story of having the United States government and the military and the Veterans Administration accept responsibility for exposure to this horrendously nasty and dangerous pesticide, Agent Orange, took forever. And it is a sad day in American history. that veterans organizations had to literally go to court against their own government, the government that sent them to Vietnam, to win the case, that Agent Orange has caused a myriad of problems. But that case was, that battle was fought and won by veterans. Now, it is understood that Agent Orange causes many, many illnesses. I believe the VA last ruled that diabetes was a result of exposure to Agent Orange. So we have made significant progress. There are many, many veterans now who are receiving disability benefits. And if any veteran is suffering the results of exposure to Agent Orange, they should absolutely go forward ask for the benefits to which they are entitled.
Bernie, we have just a little less than a minute here before the break. Any point that you want to make or quick thoughts?
Well, just I want to pick up on a point that you made earlier, Tom, and the effort on the part of the big business community and the Republicans to bring austerity to working families as a way to do deficit reduction. In my view, and I'll be holding a press conference with the leadership of the AFL-CIO, with AARP, with veterans organizations, with the National Organization for Women next week, next Thursday, to make the case that we cannot cut Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. That is absolutely unacceptable because so many of our people are hurting and we cannot make life worse for those people.
Senator Bernie Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour here on the Tom Hartman Program, your opportunity to participate in a national town hall meeting with Senator Sanders. Be sure to check out his website at sanders.senate.gov.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And you can drop by our website, tomhartman.com, drop into our free live chat room, make your own blog, participate in our message boards. It's all free. Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls. Senator, you're still with us?
I'm right here, Tom.
Okay, great. Let's see here. Al in Streamwood, Illinois. You are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Senator Sanders. It's a pleasure and an honor to speak to you.
Thank you.
Just wondering, I was reading something about the Keystone XL pipeline was going to be coming up for another vote for approval. What can you tell us about that situation?
The Keystone Pipeline is an issue of enormous consequence. The president will, I think, in the very near future, give us his decision as to whether or not that pipeline should go forward or not. I hope very much that he kills that pipeline. There are those people who think that if he gives the approval, what we will be seeing is a significant increase in greenhouse gas emissions, which could literally take us over the edge. Where we are right now, and people have got to understand this, is scientists are telling us that their worst case scenarios, the worst that they thought might happen, increasingly looks like that is exactly what will happen. And what they're now talking about is that by the end of this century, the temperature on the planet Earth may rise by as much as 8 degrees Fahrenheit. 8 degrees Fahrenheit in the next 85 years. That is unbelievable. And if, in fact, that happens, there is no question but that it will wreak havoc not only on the United States of America in terms of flooding, a drought, and extreme weather disturbances, but that will happen all over this earth. So we have got to get our act together. We have got to cut greenhouse gas emissions, not increase them. And in my view, the president should kill this Keystone pipeline.
Randy in Smock, Pennsylvania. You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Good afternoon, Senator. Since you have access to the Senate Joint Taxation Committee, why not have a printout made of all the corporations and companies that receive taxpayer subsidies and alongside their name the amount that they receive. And send a copy to each of your constituents. This will show the 47% where the other 53 goes. Thank you.
Well, Randy makes an interesting observation. And that is that you have virtually every major company in this country who receives in one form or another subsidies or tax breaks from the federal government. It goes on and on and on. And I want to pick up on Randy's point to state something that is not talked about often. When people talk about the deficit and the national debt, we've got a $16 trillion national debt, which is a lot of money. And a lot of folks, especially our right-wing friends, will say, well, the problem is simply spending, spending, spending. We're spending too much. Well, the truth is we are spending a lot of money right now because we're in the middle of a terrible recession. We choose not to see Americans go hungry. We choose to make sure that those who are unemployed receive benefits, etc. But more importantly, what is not being discussed, Tom, is that revenue, the amount of money coming into the federal government as a percentage of GDP, is now at almost its lowest point in 60 years. When Bill Clinton had a surplus during the end of his tenure, revenue was close to 20%. Now it is below 16%. And the reason for that, as Randy implies, is that we have given many tax breaks to very, very large corporations, companies on Wall Street, big energy companies. You have one out of four major corporations in America today that are profitable, not paying a nickel in taxes. We're losing $100 billion a year by companies stashing their money in the Cayman Islands and in other tax havens. So Randy's point is that the American people should know, of all of the tax breaks that are being given to large corporations, and he is absolutely right, because that is certainly one of the reasons that we have the deficit that we have, and that is an issue that we are working on right now. As a member of the Budget Committee, I'm going to do everything I can to make sure that we do not balance the budget on the backs of the elderly and the children and the sick, but that we ask these very same corporations to stop paying their fair share of taxes.
John, in Locust Grove, Georgia, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Senator. How are you?
Good.
I was wondering why the CEOs who want to raise the retirement age to 70 are the same CEOs who won't hire anyone in their 50s and 60s, and why they seem so committed to making this an impoverished nation.
Well, John,
it will hurt them.
You know, John, you got these guys who live in another planet, who make millions of dollars a year. Some of them end up being worth hundreds of millions of dollars. These are the guys who are now going to war against Social Security and Medicare. They have, in many cases, outsourced jobs from the United States to China and other countries. These are the companies that are stashing their money in the Cayman Islands, doing everything they can to avoid paying their taxes. And what the American people have got to understand, there is a war being directed against the middle class and working families. And these guys are the people who are waging that war. I mean, imagine the arrogance of people who make millions of dollars a year, who have retirement packages that the likes of which the average American couldn't even dream about. And they are saying that you got to work to 70 years of age before you get Social Security. And they are saying that we have to raise Medicare eligibility to the age of 70, that you can't have public health insurance until you are 70. That is, you know, arrogance beyond belief. And what we have got to do, as some of the callers have indicated, we have got to get on the offensive and not on the defensive. And we have to demand that these guys not continue to outsource our jobs, but reinvest in America. Demand that they start paying their fair share of taxes. Demand that they start paying the American worker a living wage. But this is a powerful group of people, and along with Citizens United, these companies can now pour huge amounts of money, often in secret, into the political process. They are very powerful. But these are the guys that we've got to take on if the middle class in this country is going to survive.
Mike in Brattleboro, Vermont. You're on the air with your senator.
Well, good afternoon, Tom. And thank you, Senator, for being on the air. I'd like to talk to you, well, ask a brief question on the status of the petitions against Citizens United. How are we progressing there?
We are making, thanks, Mike. As Mike knows, last year, as part of our, what we call our town meeting day in March, dozens and dozens and dozens, I think close to 60 separate communities, passed resolutions at their town meetings saying that a corporation is not a person, and that Citizens United has got to be overturned.
It's in the state of Vermont.
That was just in the state of Vermont. We now have cities all over America doing the same. Mike, at last count, I think we have somewhere around 9 states, I believe that is the number, of states, including the state of Vermont, where the legislatures have gone on record in saying to the Congress, send us a constitutional amendment to overturn Citizens United. We want it. We will support it. Last count, 9 states. I am working, along with other senators, with a number of grassroots organizations to make that number larger. But it is an enormously important issue. I hope dozens and dozens and dozens of states come on board and make it very clear that corporate America and a handful of billionaires should not be able to buy elections. That is not what American democracy is supposed to be about.
John, in Port Isabel, Texas, you're on the air with Senator Sanders. John?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Senator Sanders, I'm a veteran, and I avail myself of the veteran services, and I can't say enough good things about them, but they're way, way, way underfunded. Number one, and I'm from down deep in the Rio Grande Valley, right here on the very tip of Texas, and our closest hospital is a 700-mile round trip, which is pretty extraordinary. But if we could get, we have little clinics here and they're all over the country, we could get wellness centers where you had swimming pool and exercise places. Veterans really feel more comfortable together with other veterans, and I think that preventive medicine part of it would really, really go a long way.
John, thank you very much, A, for your service to our country, and B, for your suggestion. What John is talking about is a concept that the Veterans Administration has been pushing since, I believe, the 1970s, and that is a program called Community-Based Outreach Clinics, CBOCs, and those are primary health care facilities all over the country, and there are many, many hundreds of them. Tom, how are we doing on time?
We're just about out. We'll pick up your comments on this on the other side of the break.
After the break.
Okay, great. We'll be right back with more of Senator Bernie Sanders right after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Check out Bernie's website. You can sign his petition to overturn Citizens United. Sign up for his newsletter, all at sanders.senate.gov. Occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you, and it's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Sanders, just before we went to our commercial break, the person that you had talked with, the veteran you were talking with, had asked about getting a local clinic down there in the tip of Texas.
That was John from Texas. And John mentioned something that I want and I hope all veterans know about. Throughout this country now, we have hundreds and hundreds in every state in America what is called a CBOC, Community-Based Outreach Clinic. And these are clinics that provide primary health care to veterans and also are able to prescribe low-cost prescription drugs. I am a big believer in CBOCs. We now have 5 of them in the state of Vermont. We may want to expand what they do. The Veterans Administration also has many hundreds of what are called vet centers. And these are places where vets can come together informally, get counseling if they need it. And many vets who are dealing with PTSD and other problems are accessing these centers. But people who are veterans who think that they are in need of some counseling should go to the VA website and check out where your get information in your state of where you can access a VA health care and make sure that you're getting the benefits that you deserve.
Pat in Beloit, Wisconsin, listening to WCPT. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Senator, you'll love Tammy Baldwin. I just wanted to ask, well, two quick questions. One, I don't understand how the Electoral College can be manipulated by states individually when it's a national election for president. And secondly, does Harry Reid have to be the majority leader, or can that be changed so that maybe we do not have this situation again?
Well, Pat, first of all, thank you for sending Tammy Baldwin to the United States Senate. I've known Tammy for many, many years when I served in the House, and I think you're absolutely right. She is going to be one of the outstanding members of the U.S. Senate. In terms of the Electoral College, and Tom, you correct me if I'm wrong, I think we have two states right now, Maine, I know, being one, and what, Nebraska being the other?
I think so.
Maine, yeah,
Shane says you're right, so it must be.
Where they have divided up the state, and I honestly don't know the history of the or the politics of that, where they have divided up the state into two districts, each with electoral votes. Very clearly, what the Republicans are trying to do, as they do all of the time in terms of gerrymandering, this is just another form of gerrymandering, what they do with voter suppression is when you can't win an election by convincing the people of your views, you try to manipulate the system. So I'm not quite sure what the remedy of that is. Certainly, the folks at the statewide level are going to have to fight back. I don't know what the federal role in that is.
Okay. And let's see here. Steve in Perrysville, Indiana. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Senator. There's nothing they can do about the filibuster reform now.
Well,
I actually got mad enough to where I called them up and stopped making donations to them. I've been donating to them since 2011, and I'm tired of them having no backbone.
Well, Steve, thank you for calling up. I mean, the way things happen in this country is when you have an aroused population where people say to the United States Congress, hey, start worrying about me, start worrying about working families, and stop worrying about the big money interests. Now, the issue of filibuster reform, I think the bottom line here is I understand it. There was not a whip count, so I can't tell you, I don't think anyone can tell you publicly how many votes there were for the strong filibuster reform, which would have ended this 60-vote margin, which is so onerous, in my view, to addressing America's problems. My guess is what I heard is 46, 47, 48 votes. Not enough votes to do what had to be done. I voted against the bill, not because I think we didn't make a little bit of progress yesterday in making the Senate more efficient, but the bottom line is I don't think that a minority of senators, 40 senators, should be able, or 41 senators, should be able to stop the will of the majority.
So you would have been one of the votes for the strong filibuster reform.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
No, I was on record on that, absolutely.
Yeah.
And as I said earlier, the importance of that is it makes it very, very difficult for us to deal with the important issues in terms of creating jobs, in terms of dealing with the deficit in a fair way, in terms of dealing with global warming. It is going to be very, very difficult to get 60 votes. And when you get 60 votes, by and large, that legislation is going to be so watered down that in many ways it will not have the kind of impact that we need.
Bernie, we have about a minute and a half, not quite enough time to get a caller in here, but certainly enough time for you to wrap up the week for us.
Okay, well, it was an interesting week. Everybody knows that President Obama was inaugurated for his second term. I thought his remarks were very good. Frankly, they were better, I thought, than his first term inaugural speech. What we have got to do is, like Steve just indicated from Indiana, we have got to all be involved in the political process. We've got to stay glued and focused on what are the most important issues. And the important issues are creating millions of jobs, making sure that when people are working, they're earning a living wage, dealing with the very, very serious threat of global warming. And when we do that by transforming our energy system, we can create a huge number of jobs in energy efficiency and in wind, solar, geothermal, biomass, enormously important. We have got to do deficit reduction in a way that is fair, not on the backs of veterans or the elderly or the children or the sick. So, Tom, those are some of the issues that are floating around my mind right now.
Bernie, thanks so much for sharing them with us and for being on this program and for the great work you're doing in the Senate. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom.
And be sure to check out Bernie's website, sanders.senate.gov. Sign up for his newsletter, drop a note, say hi, sign his petition to overturn Citizens United. We'll be back with Anything Goes Friday.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the second hour of our program. The president got whacked down by three Republican appointees on the... Which court was this? The D.C.? So this is the First Circuit Court of Appeals, who said that when he made the recess appointments, both to the National Labor Relations Board and of... what's the guy's name? He's now appointing... For the head of the Financial Protection Bureau, Stephen Crowley is what I want to say, but I know that's not right. In any case, that when he made these appointments, that the Senate was these recess appointments, the Senate was not actually in recess; it was just in sham recess, and this was because the House wouldn't go into recess, and so Congress wasn't in recess. The Republicans were playing this game to prevent the president from doing a recess appointment because the Senate, and they were playing the game in the Senate with the filibuster, filibustering his appointees because the Democrats would have gotten these guys in a heartbeat, had the Richard Cordray, thank you, Shano, and because the Senate would have, I mean, the Democrats in the Senate would have got them in a heartbeat. And where this becomes a BFD is really, there's two pieces to it. One is this goes to the Supreme Court. And it's going to be interesting to see what happens in the Supreme Court, because you would think that an originalist like Scalia would look at the original intent of the framers of the Constitution when they put this thing in that allowed the president to appoint people during times of congressional recess, because that was back in the day when you had to ride by horseback or in a carriage for days to get from your state in Georgia or Florida or New Hampshire or whatever to Washington, D.C. And Congress, you know, was basically open for business for a few months out of the year. And the rest of the year, Congress wasn't around. Or if they were, you know, in business for a few months, then they might take a couple months off and then come back. But they were really gone. And when they were really gone, the president needed, you know, wasn't gone and needed to be able to conduct business, like appointing people. And so you could argue that either, I could see an argument on either side, either that there's basically no such thing as a congressional appointment that is so urgent that it has to be done over a long weekend or at the most, maybe a 2-week holiday that the Congress may take for the summer or for Christmas or something like that. Because it's just not like it used to be. I mean, if Congress needs to be called back on a day's notice with the modern air infrastructure that we have, it can be done. So they could just say, well, you know, the founder's intent is irrelevant. And so, therefore, when Congress tries to play games with this thing, they're just playing games, and we're not going to take that seriously. Or they could say, you know, what the Constitution says is that it has to be an adjournment. It has to be in recess with a capital R, which means that the gavel has to fall and both the House and the Senate have to say, okay, we are now officially in recess. And that never happened. And therefore, the president's appointments are not going to stand. And if we were only looking at the legal questions here, I don't know which way the Supreme Court would go. Now, on the other hand, given that there are five members of the Supreme Court who basically vote on whatever the Republicans want in the way that the Republicans want them, and in particular, and Clarence Thomas, whose wife works for the Heritage Foundation, or at least worked for the Heritage Foundation. I don't know if Jenny Thomas is still working there. And, you know, pulled like, what, $700,000 out of that organization? You know, that's now headed up by Jim DeMint and funded by the Koch brothers and others. That basically, you know, the Supreme Court has become the toady of the Republican parties. So that could be really bad news. And the reason why it's really bad news in particular is because over the last year and a half or thereabouts, since the president appointed these people to the National Labor Relations Board, the NLRB, which has to have three of its five members in office in order to actually have a quorum to hold a meeting, has made over 100 decisions, almost all of them favorable to labor, where employers were playing games with workers who wanted to try to unionize. Generally, it was this type of thing, and the NLRB said, you can't do that. You got to let them have a union if they want to have a union, or you got to let them proceed with a vote, or you've got to, you know, whatever. And over 100 of these decisions, all of them could be struck down, which could be a huge setback for organized labor, or at least a modest setback for organized labor. But you know, basically, it would also mean that the NLRB right now only has one member, and therefore it functionally doesn't exist. Labor has no representation in the federal government whatsoever. And if the Republicans continue to use the filibuster, it will stay that way, just like the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms for the last 6 years has had no head whatsoever, because the Republicans in either the House or the Senate, whichever, wherever they happen to have power at the time, have obstructed any. Well, actually, the Senate has to confirm the guy. So I guess it's been the Senate all along. The Republicans in the Senate have continuously filibustered any attempt to put somebody in charge of the ATF, the Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms Bureau. Because why? Actually, it's ATFE now. They don't use the E in the, but it's Alcohol Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives. And because of the word firearms, the NRA doesn't like them. So anyhow, that's the news of the day that I think is interesting and important and all that sort of thing. So let's pick up some of your phone calls here. Esther, I don't have a city for you. Where are you calling from?
From New York City.
Hey, you're on the air. What's up?
I was actually calling to ask Bernie Sanders a question, but I can ask you.
Okay.
My question was, number one, I wanted to ask if there was any effort underway or in the possible future to strengthen Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act. My understanding is that it was severely watered down in the hopes of getting bipartisan support, which actually didn't. And as a result, it doesn't have in it, you know, I guess the need for it to be competitive and therefore keep prices low.
Yeah, that would be the public option is what you're talking about, Esther. And we'll see if the Democrats retake the House of Representatives, if they hold on to the Senate, and if which is going to be 2 years from now, this would have to happen. And if then they hold the Senate and they either get 60 votes in the Senate or they do away with the filibuster, then I think the public option is a very real possibility / probability. In the meantime, though, starting next year and officially actually in 2016, but there's talk about a waiver, the possibility of a waiver to happen next year, 2014. States will be allowed, and Esther, thank you very much for the call and asking the question. States will be allowed to come up with their own plans for the entire state to basically opt out of Obamacare. And they can only do that under Obamacare if that plan will guarantee coverage for all the people in the state. So Massachusetts already qualifies because they've got Romney Care, which is essentially Obamacare, but it's run at the state level. And Vermont put on their ballot, actually Peter Shumlin, the current governor, 3 years ago, I think it was, ran on a platform of, if you elect me governor, I will sign legislation to make Vermont a single-payer state. He ran on that platform, and he won. And the Speaker of the House in New Hampshire, in Vermont, ran on that platform, and the President of the Senate ran on that platform, and many senators and members of the House in Vermont ran on that platform, most of them Democrats, of course. And Vermont actually passed a law to make Vermont the first single-payer state, and Peter Shumlin has actually signed that law into law. And right now, as we speak, Vermont has funded the bureaucracy necessary to administer it, and they're trying to figure out exactly how they're going to do it. It's going to take them a year or so to get ready anyway. So I think that's the big deal, as most people don't talk about.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And it's a big deal because that's how Canada got national single-payer health care, as it happened in Saskatchewan, one province, and all the other provinces said, hey, that's cool, we want that. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And John Rotz is on the line with us. And John is the founder of Gate, along with Eckhart Tolle and Jim Carrey. Am I pronouncing Eckhart's last name right?
Yeah, Eckhart Tolle is good.
and your last name?
Rotz.
Okay, great. Yeah. By the way, the website is gatecommunity.org. And the weekend after this, Gate is having a big gig in Los Angeles, and I will be speaking there Saturday night. And I'm very much looking forward to that. I'm very honored to be invited to be a part of this. And anybody who wants to come and say hi and hear my presentation or any of these other people, gatecommunity.com is the website. John, tell us, what is Gate and what are you doing a week from
this weekend? Yes, and it's gatecommunity.org, by the way.
Oh, .org. My apologies.
Yes, no problem. So Gate stands for the Global Alliance for Transformational Entertainment. And the vision of Gate is transforming the world by transforming entertainment and media. And one of our central objectives is bringing together all of those individuals in the entertainment, media, and arts communities who themselves are transformationally oriented and who wish to meet others in this space who are also of the same mindset, with the purpose of creating or developing more content of this type.
Hmm. And what kind of response have you gotten from the entertainment?
The response has been overwhelming. Real quick story, when we first tested this idea with an event at the Fox Studios Zanuck Theater in 2009, June of 2009, people thought if we had 100 people show up, we'd be doing really well. Well, 500 people showed up. We filled every seat, and we turned 1,600 people away.
Wow.
At our first big event in February of last year, 2012, we had 2,400 people. We're expecting a really great audience for this year's event. We've had people from 70 countries inquire about how they can set up chapters in their countries. And very recently, within the last few weeks, the Producers Guild of America will be honoring Gate with their Visionary Award this coming April in an award ceremony.
That is absolutely fabulous. Who are some of the other folks who are going to be participating in this weekend?
Chris Jordan, who is an extraordinary photographer and filmmaker. Paul Hawken, whom I'm sure many of your listeners know of.
Yep.
We have Olivia Newton-John will be singing some songs. Of course, you will be gracing our stage and speaking. We've just gotten word that Congressman Tim Ryan will be speaking, thanks to Lori in your office.
Mm-hmm. And Congressman Ryan is a really extraordinary person in this context because he's one of the few people in Congress who talks about mindfulness and meditation and that sort of thing.
Well, I frankly had never heard of such a thing until I learned that of his book, Mindful Nation.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got to honor that, and that must be a part of the show.
Oh, yeah.
So, and then we have a lot of people like David Corton, who wrote the wonderful book When Corporations Rule the World, mm-hmm. Duane Elgin, author of the seminal book Voluntary Simplicity, and we also have a lot of performers, singers, songwriters, we have dancers, there will be artists there. Basically, we have Roger Houston, who will be reciting some poetry. We're trying to represent as much as possible the full complement of entertainment, media, and arts concerns.
These are some serious folks. David Corton and Duane Elgin and I were all, we were part of that little group of 20-some-odd people who spent a week with His Holiness the Dalai Lama back about 6 years ago that was made into a movie that's narrated by Harrison Ford, Dalai Lama Renaissance.
I've seen it. It's a wonderful piece of work.
Yeah, it is, and they're great people. So you've got a really great gig here. This is gatecommunity.org.
Yes. Correct.
You can sign up for this. And John Rotz, I am very much looking forward to this. And John, I wanted to thank you again for inviting me.
Thank you.
Once again, remind all of our listeners that if you want to drop in and say hi, I'll be there in Los Angeles a week from tomorrow, a week from Saturday.
Yes.
On the what is the date?
February 2nd.
February 2nd.
Yes.
Thank you very much. On February 2nd in Los Angeles. So, John, thanks a whole bunch for being
with
us today.
Thank you, Tom. I appreciate it very much.
Great talking with you.
Bye-bye.
24 minutes past the hour, and John in West Sacramento, California. Hey, John, what's up?
Hey, Tom, it's good to talk to you. Something I've never done before is bothered to
9/11, quick.
Call in and make a statement. It's regarding
and
Senator
thank him
Sanders,
for being
here. And I came in back into the House on the tail end.
Now.
He's talking about some bill that would start to take away veterans' entitlements according to when they were disabled, how much would be taken from them. This concerns me as it should concern every living American. Because it's the veterans that have formed the backbone of this country, and it's the veterans, especially us, that are growing older, that deserve to be listened to.
I don't disagree at all. And that's why I think it's such a good thing that you've got a champion in Bernie Sanders, who is now the chairman of the Veterans Affairs Committee in the United States Senate. That's a BFD, as Joe Biden would say. John, thanks for the call. Mary in Seattle. Hey, Mary.
Hey, Tom. So this filibuster thing has me really fired up, and I performed the empty exercise today of calling Senator Reed's office, and I spoke to them, and I faxed him a letter. And then I thought, you know, why am I calling him? I want him to know how I feel, that I'm outraged. But what I decided was, where are my senators? So I'm from Washington State. I've got Maria Cantwell and Patty Murray. And I've worked on every one of their campaigns and sent them money and doorbelled and called and all that stuff. And I said, I want to know why they haven't, stood up and stood up for us. And what this says to me as a voter and a constituent, that they just really don't care.
Did you call their offices and learn their positions?
I did. I called both. I spoke to staffers, and they, it was interesting. Cantwell's office said, well, we're not ready to release a position on that yet. And I said, well, what is her position? And he said, well, we're not ready to release a position. I also faxed letters to them and emailed them, just to bombard them.
One of the, I don't know their, frankly, Patty Murray or Maria Cantwell's position on this, but one of the reasons, Mary, why I don't think any senator is going to come out and say right now, here's where I stood, other than, Carl Levin and Jeff Merkley, is that they don't want to be everybody wants to close ranks behind Harry Reid once this is done, and it's just the way it works.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I know it's a very unsatisfying response, but that's, the Democratic caucus wants to look like there's unity and we're all in this together, and so that's what they're going to do. Occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And one of the benefits of having somebody who's smarter than you as an associate producer here, Shano Farnan, who actually did graduate from law school, unlike me, who never went, laid on me the United States Court of Appeals, District of Columbia, argued 5 December 2012, decided January 25, 2013. It was released yesterday? Today. It was released today. Okay. That, the story I was sharing with you about how Congress could recess and there could be recess appointments. And the whole rationale was that, you know, this was so that Congress could go home for Christmas, or they'd take, you know, the summer off to go and pick the cotton or whatever, bring it in. They got their slaves to pick it, but you get the point. That actually it's worse than that. That what this court said, and this is really interesting, because this is where, when it goes to the Supreme Court, this is going to be a whole lot easier to blow up in the Supreme Court, or it's going to completely change the nature of the recess appointment. Up until this point, there have been hundreds of recess appointments, presumably, over the years, where Congress goes home for the summer, they go into recess, and the president says, okay, cool, and you know, fills judgeships and, you know, pretty much anything but cabinet-level posts, and maybe even those. But what the court said is, you know, finally, well, without reading the whole thing word for word to you, well, what they're saying is that in the Constitution, this is actually, let me read it to you from the Constitution, Article 2, Section 2, Clause 2. Article 2, Section 2, Clause 2. He shall have the power, by and with the advice and consent of the Senate, to make treaties, provided two-thirds of the senators present concur. And he shall nominate, and by and with the advice and consent of the Senate, shall employ ambassadors, other public ministers and consuls, judges of the Supreme Court, and all other officers of the United States whose appointments are not herein otherwise provided for, and which shall be abolished by law. But the Congress may by law vest the appointment of such inferior officers as they think proper in the president alone, in the courts of the law, or in the heads of the departments. The president, and then actually it's Article 3, or Section 3, subparagraph 3. The president shall have the power to fill up all vacancies that may happen during the recess of the Senate by granting commissions which shall expire at the end of their next session. Now, what this court is saying is that by saying the recess in the Constitution, the founders or the framers of the Constitution meant the time between Congresses, which is every 2 years. We just started the 113th Congress. The 112th Congress just ended. Every 2 years, there's a new Congress, because every 2 years, the entire House of Representatives is up for a re-election. And so during that, and the period of recess, I think, was less than a minute this year. I mean, it was a day. It was, you know, basically Harry Reid but I think it was very, very short. They continuously, you know, maintain Congress. And then at the very end of the second year, they say, okay, old Congress is done. New Congress starts right now. And that's the recess, according to the Federal Appeals Court. And it says, the judges say, is this difference between the choice recess and the recess which first draws our attention? When interpreting a constitutional provision, we must look at the natural meaning of the text as it would have been understood at the time of the ratification of the Constitution. Now, that's an interesting principle. Because if that's the principle that is carried forward, how this was interpreted at the time of the Constitution, at the time of ratification, then the Second Amendment means that you have the right to carry a flintlock muzzleloader. Because there were no bullets at the time of the Revolution. So anyway, this is pretty, you could argue, this is pretty radical stuff. And then, as now, the word "the" was and is a definite article, as opposed to which is an indefinite article. Unlike "a" or "an," that definite article suggests specificity, a particular thing. As a matter of cold, unadorned logic, it makes no sense to adopt the board's proposition that when the framers said the recess, what they really meant was a recess. This is not an insignificant distinction. in the end, it makes all the difference. Six different times the Constitution uses some form of the verb adjourn or the noun adjournment to refer to breaks in the proceedings of one or both houses of Congress. Twice it uses the term the recess, once in the Recess Appointments Clause and once in the Senate Vacancy Clause in the U.S. Constitution. That's Article 1, Section 3, Subparagraph 2. Not only did the framers use a different word, but none of the adjournment usages is preceded by the definite article. In other words, the word the. All this points to the inescapable conclusion that the framers intended something specific by the term the recess, and that it was something different than a generic break in proceedings. And then they go on to amplify that. The structure of the clause is to the same effect, etc. So if this is the case, it's a huge validation of originalism, I suppose, or some, you know, the concept that the Constitution is not some living, breathing is probably the wrong adjective, it's not a living document that evolves over time as the nation evolves, as Thomas Jefferson envisioned it, although he was not one of the authors of the Constitution, nor one of the signers, although he did play a big role in the background via James Madison, his protege, but that it is not a living document, that instead it is a holy or sacred document written by divinely inspired beings whose meaning we must spend all of our time figuring out, and we must apply that meaning to today because 230 years later it is still sacred script. Which takes me to the Second Amendment, meaning you have a right to, if you're a member of a well-regulated militia, you have a right to a flintlock. So, very interesting stuff. By the way, tomorrow night, I will be in Minneapolis, and that's going to be a lot of fun. We are very much looking forward to that. The AM 950's Blue State Ball. It's going to be tomorrow night, 7 to 11, at the Minneapolis Hilton. And for more information, you can go to am950radio.com, am950radio, radio.com, and Minnesota's Progressive Voice. And I'm very much looking forward to that. That's going to be a lot of fun, too. So lots coming up. Shana in Ruther Glen, Virginia. Hey, Shana, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to talk to you about the Virginia House Bill 2340 that has passed subcommittee today, basically prohibiting state law enforcement from cooperating with federal law enforcement.
Right. This is the Help a Gangbanger bill.
Is that what you call it?
Well, actually, the actual phrase that the Center for American Progress is Think Progress, they're calling it the Gangbanger Bill of Rights for gang members, you know, to withhold gun crime evidence from the federal government. Yeah.
Yeah. Can you talk about it? What do you think about it?
I think it's crazy, and I will be astounded if it passes, and if it passes, it will be subject to constitutional inspection by the federal courts. Basically, what it's saying is that Virginia is asserting the right, and of course, this isn't all of Virginia. This is, you know, some crazy Republicans in the House of Representatives in Virginia who are asserting that this is a variation on the nullification theme, you know, that is happening right now. There's big discussions of this down in, I think it's Mississippi. There's a legislator who is putting together a committee in the legislature to explore options for nullification of federal law in Mississippi. There's discussion about it in Texas. There's discussion about it in Florida, now in Virginia. These are all variations on the arguments that were made before the Civil War that the states don't have to actually pay attention to federal law, that they can nullify federal law and say, it doesn't apply here. That just applies every place else. And that was true under the Articles of Confederation. But when the states ratified the Constitution, that became not true. And so I think it's, you know, I think it's a tempest in a teapot. I think it is a hardcore right wing fringe calling out to their base in the Virginia legislature. And this is the hard right of the hard right of the Tea Party. And I frankly don't think it's going to go anywhere, and if it does, it'll be knocked down. But it demonstrates how crazy the discourse has gotten in the United States. That states, I mean, if a state can nullify a law, it has effectively seceded from the Union. And that's what these guys are talking about. So you live in Virginia. Ruth or Glenn? Virginia, Shana?
Yes, I do.
Have you talked to any of your state legislators?
Yeah, in fact, I was down at the General Assembly yesterday and on Monday talking to my representatives about gun control.
Mm-hmm. Did any of them tell you anything about this gangbanger bill of rights?
No, they sure didn't. I just found out about it today.
Yeah, okay. Well, if you learn anything, you know, from your state on the ground, call us up and let us know, okay? I just shared my opinion with you, but I'd love to hear what you're finding out there. Thanks, Shana, for calling.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
45 minutes past the hour. You know, in its purest form, this philosophy that this gangbanger Bill of Rights represents is fundamentally un-American. Helping you win the water cooler wars, Tom Hartman here with you, and let's check in on the news of the day with the Talk Radio News Service brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com, where you can give a goat to help a rescued slave and get a photo of your goat in the person you helped. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service on the line with us. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
So what's up in the world?
U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit, a three-judge panel thereof, ruled today that President Obama exceeded his constitutional authority when he named three members of the National Labor Relations Board while the Senate was on a break last year. The court ruled that allowing the president to make such appointments as a way around Senate opposition, quote, would wholly defeat the purpose of the framers and the careful separation of powers structure.
Not only that, they also ruled that every president before him who has used recess appointments that were not during the interval between one Congress and the next, which typically is a day at the end of, you know, every 2 years, that every other president that has done recess appointments, like during summer recesses, Christmas recesses, things like that, that all of those appointments are null and void as well. They didn't come out and say that, but their reasoning was that the Constitution says the recess rather than a recess. And a recess would mean Christmas, you know, vacation, that kind of thing. The recess is only the interval between the end of one Congress and the beginning of another. And that's very rarely, and in fact, I doubt ever, maybe back in the 19th or 18th century, but certainly not in the modern time, has there ever been a recess appointment during that interval.
And in fact, they adjourned. If you go to the congressional record, and Mark Noller of CBS News pulled it up, you've got Senator Wyden actually calling for the Senate to adjourn and it being agreed to.
Yes, but according to this court, according to the first district court, that doesn't matter because the only recess, that doesn't count as a recess, that counts as an adjournment. That the only recess, according to this court, I refer you to page 16 of the decision. If when you get a hold of the PDF, read page 16 and 17. It'll blow your mind. The only recess that they believe that this court is asserting a president can use for recess appointments is the recess, the interval of time between two Congresses.
Well, it certainly blew the mind of Richard Trumka, the president of the AFL-CIO, who said the decision was nothing less than shocking.
Yes.
Said it was a radical and unprecedented decision and said the court interpreted the Constitution in a way that would deprive both Republican and Democratic presidents of a critical tool.
Well, and let me tell you how radical it was. They say in this, I'm quoting from the ruling, it is this difference between the word choice recess and the recess that first draws our attention. And when interpreting this provision, and then they go through this, then they talk about how, you know, the Senate, how this language I'll have to do it from memory. There was a point in here where they say, therefore, we have to, you know, look back at. Oh, here it is. All this points to the inescapable conclusion that the framers intended something specific by the term the recess and that it was something different than a generic break in proceedings. And so what they're saying here is not only that there's a difference between, you know, adjournments and recess and the recess between Congresses, but they're also saying that constitutional law, that law has to be interpreted in the context of what the founders and framers meant at that time, which means if you extend this logic, and these people were on the Supreme Court, that in the Second Amendment, if you're the member of a well-regulated militia, you have a right to a flintlock. But there were no bullets at that time, and so that was not contemplated by the founders and framers. I mean, this is originalism run amok.
Wow.
Pardon my rant, but
rant away.
Yeah, and a tip to the hat of, by the way, of the hat to Shane O'Farnon here, who enlightened me on this. So
it's going to be fascinating. The Justice Department has responded, saying that they completely disagree with this, said very politely, has not yet said whether it will appeal, but I believe that they will.
The thing that I'm hoping some eager beaver reporter will uncover is how many other recess appointments have been made by how many other presidents, and who were they in what years when those appointments were not made during that interval when one Congress ends and the next Congress begins, which under this ruling is the only recess that counts.
I think we'll find it numerous.
Yes, I think we'll find it humorous and fascinating. So what else is going on?
Well, an advisory panel of experts to the FDA is going to vote today on whether to toughen restrictions on hydrocodone products like Vicodin, most widely used narcotic painkillers in the country. Mm. Now, these recommendations are likely to be followed by the FDA. They would limit access to the drugs by making them harder to prescribe. They would do things like refills without a new prescription would be forbidden, as would fax prescriptions and those called in by phone. Only written prescriptions from a doctor would be allowed, and pharmacists and distributors would be required to store the drugs in special vaults.
Yeah, we did an hour on this on the show earlier this week, and I was asking the question, you know, addiction in and of itself is not fatal. But at the same time, the study came out of Finland showing that cola drinks increase a man's risk of prostate cancer by 40%, one drink a day. And, you know, which is fatal. And, you know, are we regulating the wrong things? And a longtime listener, Narlodia, sent me a note saying, might this have something to do with the fact that we're preparing to leave Afghanistan, which is the largest producer of opium in the world, and we're basically saying, okay, we're going to dial back on opiates, you think?
Well, that's a possibility. You never know how deep these things go.
Really? Yeah. Okay. What else
also,
is up?
Look out next week for a major launch on immigration reform. The White House, the president will begin his second term immigration push during a trip Tuesday in Las Vegas, and a Senate working group is aiming to outline its proposals about the same time. So a lot of talk of immigration reform next week.
Yeah. Well, I think this is where the Republicans are saying we shot ourselves in the foot and we've got to get on this train here.
Yeah. The president got 70% of the Hispanic vote.
Yep. Yep.
And it's a problem.
Yep. Absolutely. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you, Tom.
Great talking with you. We will be back with more of Anything Goes Friday in just a moment. And by the way, we've got a new app for the iPad, iPhone, optimized for the cool new high-resolution screen and everything. Tom Hartman app over at the App Store. Check it out. Yeah.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Curiouser and curiouser. Digging into this decision by the... In the case National Labor Relations Board versus International Brotherhood of Teamsters. Very interested to know what James Hoffa thinks about this. He being the president of the Teamsters, although this is a local 760. But this is in the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, the D.C. Circuit of the U.S. Court of Appeals. And they're saying, you know, I said that it would be The recess would be between Congresses. But then I read a couple more pages, and they're saying, no, it's between sessions, and that there's typically two sessions in a Congress. which is year one, year two, that basically a session is ended at the end of a year, and then the next one begins at the next year. But George W. Bush put John Bolton in with a recess appointment, if Shano's research is correct, in 2005, and he stayed there until the end, until January 2007, the beginning of the next Congress. So for 2 years. So the question under this ruling, John Bolton was never the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. Yeah? Very interesting. Very interesting. Oh, meanwhile, another, by the way, commit torture, get a get out of jail free card. Out the government for committing torture, John Curacao sentenced to 30 months in prison. Now, what's particularly interesting about this is that Curacao was sentenced. Thought I had the story here in front of me. Apparently I don't. Oh, here it is. He was sentenced under the under a law that had to do with basically outing people involved in the secret people and secrets. He was he pled guilty in October to the single charge of leaking the identity of one of the agency's covert operatives to a reporter. So this was the law that protects the identity of CIA officers. So this guy went to jail for 30 months. We know that Dick Cheney actually wrote a memo, basically, or notes in the margin of a memo, directed his right-hand guy, Scooter Libby, to out Valerie Plame, Joe Wilson's wife, from the CIA. Why did Dick Cheney not go to prison for 30 months? Or Scooter Libby, for that matter. Well, Scooter Libby ended up, you know, getting the grand pardon or some variation thereof from Bush, didn't he? Didn't Scooter Libby get pardoned by Bush? Commuted. Commutation. That's right. He wasn't pardoned, and that PO'd Dick Cheney because he wanted it to be a full pardon. Therefore, there was never a crime to begin with. And Bush said, no, we're just not going to send him to jail. But the crime stands. And because I think George Bush knew somebody had to take the fall for Dick Cheney's crime. But nobody went to prison. But in this case, this guy, John Curacao, Kiriakou. Thank you. John Kiriakou, who was the source of the stories for the New York Times, he actually went to prison. Amazing. Michael, in Camino Island, Washington, you wanted to talk about John Kiriakou.
Well, just about covered everything I wanted to talk about. I guess I'm just wondering why nobody's going to go after the Cheney administration people.
I'm wondering if the statute of limitations has expired.
Would that be close to treason, wouldn't it? Is there a statute of limitations on that kind of stuff?
Well, they didn't charge this guy with treason. They charged him with specifically violating this law. So I think
right. He copped a plea, though. Also, you know, the guy's kind of a hero. He got a really head of the operation that got one of the really bad Al Qaeda financiers.
Yeah. Yeah.
And but I was yeah. So well, you pretty much covered everything I had to say.
Okay. All right. Thanks a lot for the call. Appreciate it.
Thanks.
Craig in Crestview, Florida. Hey, Craig.
Hey, yeah, I know you're kind of a numbers guy and all, and with Biden talking about replacing assault guns with shotguns instead.
He didn't talk about replacing them. I think the essence of what he said was, if somebody's trying to break into your house, you're better off with a shotgun than an assault weapon. And, most people who've used a shotgun would probably agree with that.
Well, women have a problem lifting a heavier weapon. They'd be better off with a handgun and knowing how to use it. But what he's saying is the shotgun is more effective. So he's essentially calling for more people to die by using a shotgun instead of an assault gun. And, you know, I work 911 for a living.
A, you're saying that women are weak and incapable of lifting a shotgun, which I know that there's a lot of women out there that would
and smaller men. I mean,
would be standing in line to lift a shotgun and demonstrate to you that they actually know how to hold it and maybe blow parts of your anatomy off. And secondly, you know, the idea that Joe Biden, by saying, you know, defend your home with a shotgun instead of an assault weapon, is going to cause more people to die is absurd on its face, Craig.
Sure, it's going to happen. You need
50 shots
instead of pistols. If you use shotguns instead of pistols or assault guns, more people will die.
So, okay. So what you want to do is do you work for the NRA?
No, I'm a 911 operator. I've listened to people commit suicide by shotgun and pistol. And the ones who use shotguns die. The ones who use pistols maybe die, maybe don't.
Yeah. Okay. So then Joe Biden is right that a shotgun is more effective at killing people than a pistol. I think he just vetoed your own logic, didn't you, Craig?
No, I'm saying that he's essentially calling for more people to die.
I think it was a comment in passing. Well, it wasn't just a comment in passing. It was a comment. It was asserting that there's no reason for anybody to have an assault weapon unless they're on the field of battle. That you don't need a 50 shot clip to defend your home.
Well, and like I said, you're a numbers guy, so you know for a fact that only 300 murders of the year come by so-called assault guns. The other 9,700 by gun come by pistols and shotguns. So the assault weapons ban really isn't what the issue is about when you're talking about random.
Well, then the assault weapons ban is not that big a deal, and you guys should be just all hunky-dory with it. If people don't use them that much. Very few people are getting killed with them, so... You know, hey, let's pull them off the market. They're destructive weapons of war.
Hardly anybody's getting killed with it. Far more are getting killed by the other 9,700 guns.
Well, great then. Proportionally, I mean, this is a classic example of figures can lie and liars can figure. What is the ratio of assault weapons to all rifles, pistols, and shotguns in the nation? Do you know?
No.
So I'm guessing when the NRA or whoever put, you know, cooked together the numbers for you about, you know, 300 people murdered by assault weapons and you know, lots and lots, 10,000 people murdered by everything else, they didn't provide you with that proportion. Do you think that it is less than 0.3%?
That's the FBI statistics that I'm quoting.
Okay. Yeah. Well, whoever went to the trouble of digging them out of the FBI. Do you think that so you're asserting that assault weapons are responsible for, if I'm doing my math right here, about 0.3% of the murders? Do they represent more or less than 0.3% of the weapons out there?
I don't know the answer.
Yeah, neither do I. And when we find out, then I guess we can have a conversation about it. 15 minutes past the hour. But basically, it's like, oh, let's pick on Joe Biden because he's the guy who's out there trying to clean this mess up.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I think that's kind of sad and cheap. 15 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Mark in Montgomery, Illinois. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Long time no talk, my friend.
Thank you.
I wanted to talk about this Virginia redistricting and this gerrymandering maneuver that went on. Since the year 2000, officially Martin Luther King Day is recognized by the Commonwealth of Virginia, and I want to know why the General Assembly was open in the first place. I looked at the Richmond City website. Public workers that are not essential take as a holiday. I don't know how the clerk of the Senate would have had the day working, so how would she have recorded the vote? The sergeant-at-arms probably would have had the day off. So I'm putting to you that this was completely bogus. I don't know if you're aware of this. It's called Lobby Day, 2013 Freedom Agenda, brought on by the Northern Virginia Tea Party. And I'm looking at it, and they were there at the Capitol.
So
on Martin Luther King Day,
Right.
And it says from 7 a.m. to 5 p.m. And this has been going on. This went on last year. You could look it up at Lobby Day 2013 Eventbrite.com. What's that about?
Yeah. So your contention is that when the Virginia Senate passed this different way of determining the Electoral College votes by congressional district rather than by winner-take-all in the state, when they passed that 20-19, that and it would not have passed had the one senator who had come to Washington, D.C., the civil rights icon, I think his name was Marsh, was it not?
Senator Marsh.
Senator Marsh, right.
McDonald and, Bowling, the lieutenant governor, they're acting like they never knew this was happening, and Bowling would have to be the one to bring the Senate back into session if it were an emergency. Now, taking this kind of a vote isn't an emergency.
Right, and Martin Luther King Day is a federal holiday and a state-recognized federal holiday, and therefore the state employees who would be necessary for the state Senate to function were not working that day, so how could the state Senate have met? That's
right.
A very good argument, Mark. That's a very good argument.
Now, the other thing is that, I've lost it.
That's quite all right. But yeah. I'm guessing the Senator Marsh figured that, too. He figured, hey, it's a holiday. I can leave for a day. I can go to the president's inauguration. It's a holiday. The state workers are not going to be working there. There's not going to be the clerk of the Senate to record the notes and bring the Senate into session, all those kind of things.
But I want you to check out this Lobby Day 2013, and it says by the Northern Virginia Tea Party.com, which is, and they said that they were at the Capitol, their meeting. So I've never heard this. I just looked it up online today. And you don't open up these, the capitals. I know Illinois state capitals not open on any of these official holidays. So what's going on here?
Right, right. Yeah, it's sounding snarkier or stinkier or whatever, and weirder and weirder. Mark, thank you for that. I tell you, we've got the smartest listeners on earth. Lobby Day 2013, I'm going to look into that. Robert in Great Court, South Carolina. Hey, Robert, what's up?
I was listening to a conservative talk show yesterday, and a fellow called in advocating an armed overthrow of the government.
Mm-hmm.
And I called in and said, well, our Constitution provides for the removal of the government and replacement by way of the vote.
Yeah, it's called elections.
The host of the show said the voting doesn't work, and he pretty much ridiculed my comment. But, you can remove the government all at once, but you could in a series of elections. That is, elections, that are required by law.
Mm-hmm.
Remove the government and replace it with the one,
with a new one.
Voters.
Right, with one that will serve your needs and respond to your demands. Absolutely. And excellent comment. Thank you very much, Robert, for the call. Dave in Stoddard, Wisconsin, you wanted to comment on the comment on Joe Biden's comment about shotguns?
Yeah, shotguns are several different kind of shots. I mean, if you're firing a slug, yeah, it's very deadly, but there's birdshot. There's a lot of things you can use.
Yeah, just ask Kerry, what's his name, Wetherington or whatever, the guy that Dick Cheney shot in the face with a shotgun.
Right. I guess he didn't die, did he?
No. At least he didn't die then. Harry may no longer be with us now. I don't know, but he didn't die then. No, in fact, he lived to apologize to Dick Cheney for standing in front of his shotgun.
Right. These guys, they come up with these facts or these statistics, but they don't mean anything because they don't define them.
Yeah.
I really like that point about why they were open. I have no idea if any other states are open or what's the story there, but it's interesting. That's a great point he brought.
Absolutely. I had not thought of it, and it makes such perfect sense. How could the Virginia State Senate be functioning on a federal and state holiday when all the employees necessary to help the Senate function, like, transcribing their minutes and the sergeant at arms and all this other stuff, were on vacation or on holiday because it's a day off? I don't know. I think it's absolutely fascinating. Thank you, Dave. Richard in Blue Mounds, Wisconsin. Hey, Richard, what's up?
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I was just wondering if you knew that Paul Ryan wants to do away or do something with Social Security.
Yeah, he's talked in the past about privatizing it, handing it off to Wall Street.
Yeah. Did you know that he went to college with Social Security?
Yeah, his father died when he was a teenager, and he lived on Social Security, he and his mother and his siblings.
Right.
Yeah.
But they were a very wealthy family anyway.
I didn't know that.
Yes.
Doesn't surprise me.
Ryan Construction Company.
Ah, okay. So then his story of living on Social Security is a phony rags-to-riches story?
Right, I believe so, yeah.
Yeah. You know, there's so much phony about Paul Ryan. I remember when we had the woman on who took the picture of him with the lobbyist and the $600, you know, the two $350 bottles of wine. And, you know, at one of the fancy restaurants here in D.C., it's just, you know, Paul Ryan is, well, enough said. Richard, thank you for the call. And my sympathies. You live there in Wisconsin, having to... Well, hopefully you can do something about it. Hopefully you can vote him out next time around. 27 minutes past.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
From really snowy Washington, D.C. And by the way, we got the water working in the boat today. I'll tell you how after the break. Amazing. Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Talking Points memo reporting... this is astounding. Mitch McConnell, the Senate Minority Leader, the Senate Republican Leader, after Harry Reid had a handshake deal with him, which both of them asserted was done in good faith to make the Senate work well, sent out an email to his supporters. The subject line was, "We beat the liberals." Quoting from TPM's article by Shahil Kapoor, the email subject line, "We beat the liberals," bragged that President Obama was, quote, furious after liberal senators and left-wing groups failed to pass their, quote, dangerous scheme to break down the checks and balances in the Senate. Amazing. We beat the liberals. Well, they did. They did. Harry Reid took Mitch McConnell's word for something. And as Harry Reid has pointed out, he did that 2 years ago, and it was a mistake. You know, it's like Lucy in the football. It really is. You know, Charlie Brown, "Hey, Lucy, you know, you're not going to pull that football back if I come to kick it, are you?" "No, no, no, don't worry, Charlie Brown. You're not going to filibuster that bill if I bring it to the floor." "No, no, don't worry, Harry Reid." Here's another incredible irony. You know, Virginia wants to go from being like, you know, pretty much every other state in the union where, apparently with the exception of Nebraska and Maine, which I have to look up over the weekend, but going from a winner-take-all state, in other words, President Obama won Virginia, so he gets all of Virginia's electoral votes. They want to go from that to allocating their electoral votes based on congressional districts. The headline says it all. Let me, before I read this headline to you, remind you of this little bit of American history, that when the Constitution was being put together and they were determining how many members of the House of Representatives each state would get, because every state gets two senators, but they get a varying number of representatives, two, three, five, six, one, you know, as few as one. And they were determining how many representatives you get. That's based on how many people you have in your state. Specifically, how many potential voters, which back in the day was mostly white males. And the southern states, which didn't have so many white males, they had a lot of African-American males, the slaves. The southern states said, "Hey, wait a minute. We're not going to end up with very many representatives. We got a large population here. We deserve to have more representatives in the House of Representatives, more votes." And so they said, "We want our slaves to be counted for the purposes, at least the male slaves, to be counted for the purposes of apportionment, of how many representatives we get." And the northern states said, are you kidding? Your slaves can't vote. So why do you want them to be counted towards the population that determines how many members of the House of Representatives you get? And so then the guys in the South, the slave owners, they said, well, you've got indentured white people in the North, which was true. There were tens of thousands of them, perhaps more. People who had come over from Europe on an indenture, basically, I will work for you for the rest of my life or for a particular period of time. Typically, they were 5, 10, 15, or 20-year indentures. I will be basically your servant in exchange for you paying for passage. And, I mean, people did this to flee Europe, to come to America, to come to the promised land, knowing that their kids wouldn't be indentured. They would be in, you know, better world, all that kind of thing. And the indentured servants were not voting in the North, and they had no rights. They were basically considered property. In fact, indentures could be sold from one person to another in some states. And so the people in the South said, what, you're going to count all the white people in the North, even the ones who are indentured? But you're not going to count all the people in the South because some of them are slaves? And so the people in the North said, well, I guess you got a point. Let's work out a compromise. We'll count all of the white folks in the North, and we'll count 3/5 of the African-Americans in the South. And then the other thing that the people in the South brought up was, what about all those Indians you got up there? New York State's got, you know, five nations, Indians in it, the Iroquois Confederacy. You going to count the Indians? And so in that 3/5 compromise, if you read the language, it's right there in the Constitution, it says that the only Indians who would be counted are those who pay taxes. In other words, who are no longer living as a Native American, but are now living as a white person, who have, you know, left the Native American lifestyle and come into the city to work and you know, whatever. It's the 3/5 compromise it's referred to as. 3/5 of the black people in the South would be counted towards determining how many members of the House of Representatives the slave states would get. So back to the headline over at TPM. Obama would have received 3/5, our first African-American president, would have received 3/5 of the Virginia popular vote share under the GOP plan. Talk about ripe with irony. This is absolutely astounding. Absolutely astounding. Ray in Galleon, Ohio. Fear of a constitutional,
yes, sir.
You're afraid of having a constitutional lawyer as president?
No, I'm not afraid at all.
Oh,
I think the conservatives are afraid of that.
Ah, okay. See,
I don't think it's black and white at all, Tom.
Mm-hmm.
I think that because Barack Obama is a constitutional scholar,
mm-hmm.
that put the fear of the Constitution into them.
Yeah.
I know more. I'm 62 years old, and I know more about the Constitution now than I have in my whole life because they have twisted the Constitution into a pretzel.
Yeah,
they have put it under a microscope, and they are using it to their advantage.
I agree. But I would submit to you, Ray, that the opposition, the really full-throated, freaked-out, hair-on-fire opposition to President Obama coming from the hard right is not so much because he's a constitutional lawyer. It is more, A, because he's a Democrat, and B, and maybe these are reversed in order, B, because he's an African-American.
Well, I'm not saying that they're not using racism. They are using the ill-informed, the racists. They are using them against him.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But I really don't think it's a racist thing. I think they fear his ability, his intelligence.
Yeah.
In this matter.
But he is a very very smart man. The guy was a professor of law. I'm with you, Ray. Thank you for the call, Nancy in Oak Lawn, Illinois, listening on WCPT. Hey, Nancy.
Hey, Tom. My question is, if these Republicans that, you know, changed the whole thing about the recess appointments?
Yeah, the three Republican appointees on the D.C. Court of Appeals.
Right.
Right.
Wasn't Libby excused or whatever he was on recess? I believe he was. And doesn't that mean he should be put back in jail and along with Dick Cheney, if you ask me?
Scooter Libby's commutation had nothing to do with the recess, but John Bolton's appointment to be the U.N. ambassador.
I thought I remember W. doing that when...
He can commute a sentence anytime he wants. It doesn't depend on Congress.
Oh, I thought I heard something about that, and I don't remember why he would have done it then. But
no, but there,
I am just so frustrated with all these Democrats giving away the store, and then these guys turn around and kick them right in the butt again.
Yeah, I don't disagree. It's just it's astounding to me that Mitch McConnell had the chutzpah to send out an email today titled "We Beat the Liberals." It's astounding. Andrew, in Ashland, Pennsylvania, you think we're heading towards a tyrannical government, really?
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I was just listening to what happened to the CIA officer who apparently revealed some or maybe declassified some information about torture. And also, I heard you saying that we should be going after, you know, the people who first started torture, you know, the previous administration.
Yes.
The only entity that could potentially go after the previous administration is the current administration. And instead, they're really now imprisoning whistleblower, and we know they're also going after investigative journalists and, you know, all kind of people who are, you know, for freedom and liberty. So the question is, which administration is more tyrannical? And does it matter which, you know, which president we would have had, whether it was McCain?
The argument, you know, yes, President Obama has prosecuted more whistleblowers than any president before him or his administration has. But the larger question is, which is more important, breaking the law, which the Bush administration did, or ignoring the people who broke the law, which the Obama administration is doing? I think they're both important, but I think breaking the law is worse, frankly. So, if that's your measure of, you know, who's a tyrannical leader, I think George Bush comes above Obama in that order. But I think that they're both wrong. They shouldn't have tortured, and he shouldn't be ignoring it.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Now, on the third hand, if this fellow actually leaked a CIA officer's name, perhaps he should be prosecuted, but then so should Dick Cheney. Hey, thanks so much to our show director, Louise Hartman, to my executive producer, Sean Taylor, to our associate producer, Shane Farnan, to our video director, Jim Javinsky, to our phone screener, Danielle Gilday, to our writer-researcher, Sam Sachs, to Alva Goldbrook for video production, to our webmasters, Nigel Peacock and Jamie Holly, our business manager, Ron Hartenbaum, all the various companies that syndicate our program, Pacifica Radio, Dial Global, TRN Network, Free Speech TV on Dish Network, DirecTV, all the cable providers who carry our show, Comcast, Manhattan Neighborhood Network, all the others around the country, and all the great folks at Free Speech TV and RTTV who work on The Big Picture, to our newsletter editor and all the great folks, Sue Nethercutt, and all the great folks in our chat room who hang out with her every day, to Ellen Ratner and Victoria Jones and everyone at the Talk Radio News Service, to Jay Tamboli, Jay Goodman Tamboli for our tech support, to our affiliates, our radio and television station affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for supporting our program. Thank you, and I mean that genuinely. We would not be here were it not for your support in listening and letting sponsors and underwriters know that you support the program and letting stations know that you support the program. It's all really important stuff. It's really important stuff. So, Steve in DeKalb, Illinois. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Real fast, the thing that bothers me the most about the Harry Reid situation is I'm really concerned that we're going to see another 2010, because back then the Democrats were really bummed out about Obama not supporting the health care reform as much as he could have. I mean, he.
Well, the argument was that he didn't use the bully pulpit to push for a public option, but the blowback or the pushback from that, and we actually had somebody from the White House on this program talking about it, was that he didn't have the votes in the Senate.
Right, but
to get past
time,
the filibuster,
I don't know if you remember,
to get past the damn filibuster.
Everybody was really ticked off because he kept making these deals where the voters, because we don't know what's going on behind the scenes, all we think we see is that he's caving.
Yeah.
And so by the time 2010 got here, we were road weary. We were tired of defending him and you know, all of these things. And nobody showed up. And then we got this influx of these nut jobs, these crazy people. I'm afraid that it's going to be like that on steroids this time.
In 2014.
We just went through a painful election.
Yeah. Mitch McConnell might as well have said yesterday, my number one job is to make sure that the Democrats only control the Senate for another 2 years.
I am really worried that this is the last nail in the coffin. And I know we are known for feeling this way every time we perceive something bad to happen. But if you just use the logic of 2010, if people don't show up in 2014, we have a huge problem because we're not going to be able to turn things around with all the gerrymandering and everything.
Yeah. No, I'm totally with you, Stephen. And let me just put a punctuation mark on that. 2 years back in 2010, when in general, Democrats, progressives, whatever, were saying that the president hadn't been strong enough or the Democrats weren't strong enough, what they really should have been saying was Mitch McConnell is messing with us. Because for 2 years, 2008 and 2009, and well, actually 2009 and 2010, for 2 years, Nancy Pelosi and the House of Representatives produced over 300 really good, solid pieces of progressive legislation that would have dropped the unemployment rate down to 4 or 5%, would have put a lot of Americans back to work, would have brought our jobs back home, would have stopped the ability of Mitt Romney and his class from stashing their money in offshore accounts, would have, you know, strengthened our tax collection, would have put this country on a good footing. And it wasn't the lack of leadership. It wasn't a lack of leadership. The president was ready to sign those bills and advocated for them. Nancy Pelosi worked her butt off, worked tirelessly to get this stuff through the House of Representatives. And we got more than 50 votes for all of them in the Senate. But Mitch McConnell, the one guy, said, no, you're going to have 60 votes. We're going to enforce a filibuster. And in many cases, we don't even know who the individual Republican senator was who sent the email to Mitch McConnell saying, would you please stop that piece of legislation? And I agree with your prediction of the outcome with one codicil, with one caveat. And that is that if we begin to identify the obstructionists and the obstruction, if the president begins to behave like Harry Truman did when he had the exact same problem with the Congress of 1946 and 47, or 47 and 48, actually, it was the Congress that was elected in November of 46. You know, the Republicans held the Congress for 2 years between the late 1920s and the 1980s. Only 2 years, that entire period of time. And the reason that the Republicans never got Congress back was because Harry Truman pointed out that it was the Republicans in Congress who were obstructing legislation, who were preventing him from doing the progressive things that the people wanted. And then finally, the people said, OK, enough of that already. And we have to point out every single time that the Democrats try to bring something decent to the floor of the Senate and have 50 votes to make it happen, that it is Mitch McConnell and the Republicans who are obstructing it, rather than the circular firing squad of, oh, well, the president didn't talk loud enough, or, oh, well, the Democrats didn't do it, because that has been the truth all along. Am I making sense here, Steve?
Sure, absolutely. But the problem with that is President Obama won't even say the word Republican.
He's going to have to start. He's going to have to start.
He's so polite and presidential.
He is going to have to start.
I really don't see that happening.
If he doesn't take a lesson, you know, your prediction will come true if President Obama does not, particularly given what happened yesterday and today with this and Harry Reid, or excuse me, with Mitch McConnell sending out this email now to his supporters saying we beat the liberals. If the president doesn't take a lesson from Harry Truman and start behaving the way Harry Truman did, then yes, the Republicans in 2 years are going to take the Senate, they're going to hold the House, and in 4 years they'll take the White House. And it's going to be a very bizarre country when that happens. And on the other hand, if the president does take a lesson from Harry Truman, the Democrats will hold the Senate, they'll go back the House, and they'll have a chance in 2 years to finally blow up the filibuster. Coming up Monday, we'll bring you the latest on the latest news and information from the weekend. What are the Republicans up to next? Plus, the state of Virginia passing a gangbanger's bill of rights? It's bizarre. I'll have a discussion with Philip Van Cleve, president of Virginia Citizens Defense League. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Get out there, get active, show up, participate, tag, you're it. See you on Monday.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.